The order of the House Committee on Human Services. Today, January 21st, 2009. Thank you all, committee. And we're going to have an informational meeting this morning about the Psychiatric Security Review Board, PSRB General Overview. And we have Mary Claire Buckley, who is the Executive Director of PSRB. And she will be opening, and the other folks will introduce themselves. Hi, Claire.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I am the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Review Board. With me today at the table are a gentleman that many may know, Mr. Barry Cass, who is the public member and current chair of the board, as well as Bonnie Lambert, who is the program manager for PSRB clients at Cascadia Behavioral Health Program in Portland that serves a number of our clients on an outpatient basis. Also, I have the pleasure this morning of having three of our consumers, two graduates and one current client, Ashley Brenton, Susan Grenewald, and Peter Clarquist, who will also be speaking to you a little bit later about their history and experience under the board. But first, Madam Chair, on behalf of the board, I want to thank you very much for this opportunity and invitation to appear and share with your committee information about the Psychiatric Security Review Board, its operations, and its clients. If I have learned anything in the past year as a result of the increased attention and scrutiny being focused on the board and the placement of its clients, it is how critically important education is to a true and accurate understanding and assessment of this system and the minimal risk that these clients actually pose to communities after being treated and served at the state hospital. To that end, I have provided members with a packet of materials, which includes a single two-sided sheet, sort of a fact sheet, a snapshot of our clientele as of the first of the year, as well as a copy of a PowerPoint presentation to which I will refer in my presentation. But before I get into the details regarding the board and its functions, I believe it is important to have a clear understanding of who its clients are and how they came to be under the board's jurisdiction, because that, too, has been a source of misinformation. The board assumes jurisdiction over all those found guilty except for insanity of a crime in Oregon who could pose a substantial danger to others. I would note that as of July 1, 2007, this legislature has expanded the board's responsibilities to include young offenders, juveniles, who have been found responsible except for insanity in the juvenile justice system. However, that panel has only four clients, and we're just starting that process. And so my comments today will be focused solely on the adult system, the adult panel, and its clients. Simply put, these clients are individuals who successfully asserted the insanity defense to a criminal charge. But contrary to popular belief, to do so is neither a common nor an easy thing to do. Nationally, I believe the data shows that about 0.25% of all prosecutions successfully assert the insanity defense. In Oregon, the numbers reflect much the same. I think in the calendar year 2008, there were approximately 18,000 felony convictions in this state, and the board received 70 clients. So if I do my math right, that's somewhere between a third of 1% of individuals in Oregon ended up under the board after being charged with a crime. Further, it is not just a matter of a defense attorney deciding to put a client under the board and somehow receiving the consent of the district attorney. The law requires that a psychiatric or psychological evaluation be performed to determine if the person suffers from a mental disease or defect. And if that person is suffering from a mental disease or defect at the time of the crime, whether they could not, because of that illness, could not either appreciate the criminality of their conduct or they could not conform their conduct to the requirements of law. That is the legal standard. The statute further excludes personality disorders from the definition of mental disease or defect. Thus, the fundamental premise of the insanity defense is that it is the mental disease that caused the individual to commit the crime. But for that, it would not have occurred. It is not because the individual is antisocial by nature, as are the majority in correctional institutions. They do not commit their crimes because they are callous, greedy, deceitful, manipulative, or have a reckless disregard for the rights and feelings of others, as is the case with many criminal offenders, as I'm sure Representative Olson can attest from his professional experience. Rather, it is the result of a brain disorder that was untreated, became active, causing psychotic thinking and the commission of a crime. I think this distinction is important and should inform the way this legislature and hopefully the public eventually views this population. Because despite the tragedy of this circumstance, the positive news is that these types of mental diseases can be treated with medications and supports and services, and if so, the persons afflicted can and do recover and refrain from further criminal activity. And before you are three examples of many in this state who you will hear from, as I said, later in this presentation. Thus, rather than being more dangerous than other offenders, as some believe, they are significantly less so if provided with the resources they need. But in order to assure that these individuals obtain these necessary treatment and support services and to continue to avail themselves of it and follow through, frankly, and to assure the public is protected, the Oregon Legislature in 1977 created the Psychiatric Security Review Board. After study by a couple of task forces, it was determined that the previous system that left the responsibility for these individuals in the hands of the trial judges who had handled their cases was inadequate and did not provide, because it did not provide for staffing or resources to track and monitor them. There was widespread concern that that system did nothing to ensure public safety. Thus, jurisdiction was transferred from the trial courts to this state agency upon disposition, and the board became responsible for all future decisions regarding these individuals' placements. The board was created as an independent entity to ensure the board's autonomy in that decision-making process. It was a unique experiment at the time, the first of its kind in the country. It was set up and continues to be today, multidisciplinary in nature, comprised by statute of five members, including by law a psychiatrist, a psychologist, an attorney experienced in criminal law, a parole or probation officer, and a member of the general public. Its primary purpose then and today is to protect the public. The board's commitment to this directive, I believe, is evidenced by its recidivism rate, which currently averages a little over 2% since the board began keeping performance measures in 1992. The functions of the board are set out in the enabling statutes, but none is more important than to protect the public. The board accepts the responsibility for these individuals upon receipt of a judgment order from a court. Most of our clients are initially, about 75% of them are initially committed to the state hospital for care and treatment, where they remain until the board, in collaboration with state hospital treatment professionals and community providers, determine that they are appropriate for a return to the community. Thus, the board's mission is to protect the public through the ongoing review of the progress of these persons found guilty except for insanity and a determination of their appropriate placement, be it the Oregon State Hospital on a highly structured and supervised status of what is referred to in the statute as conditional release, although I will say that I think for some that term, although it's the statutory term, is a bit of a misnomer because people, when they hear release, think that these people are free. And in fact, when we refer to conditional release, it's really almost a conditional transfer of sorts from a hospital setting to the community setting. The board still is very involved, and you'll hear from the community providers as well as, I think, from our consumers that, in fact, sometimes people believe that the board is too involved in these individuals' lives when they're released from the hospital. But in any event, the other option for the board is to discharge the individual if, in fact, the individual no longer meets the legal criteria, that is, that they have a mental disease or defect and continue to pose a substantial danger to others when that illness is active. Now, the board carries out its mission through two arenas. One is the hearings process, which is the forum in which the board receives information and those decisions regarding placement are made. The other is monitoring, which for purposes of the public is the most critical piece of our job, which is initiated when the client returns to the community setting. The statute set forth the various types of hearings and the time frames for which the board has to hold these hearings, as well as the notice provisions. At each hearing, the board has to make those jurisdictional findings as well as determine whether the individual remains at the hospital or is ready to start the process for return to the community. These hearings are quasi-judicial in nature. The board sits in panels of three almost weekly, and these hearings are held at Oregon State Hospital. Because the board has such a say in these individuals' lives, and it affects a liberty interest, the board does afford its clients due process rights, which include the right to request a hearing, the right to have counsel appointed if they are indigent, which most of our clients are, to examine the exhibits that are going to be considered by the board, to subpoena witnesses, to cross-examine witnesses, and ultimately to appeal any adverse decision directly to the Oregon Court of Appeals. Now, in that process, the board is always assessing an individual's readiness for conditional release. And at this point, I would ask our board member, Mr. Cass, to describe from the board member's perspective how these decisions are made.
Thank you, Mary Claire. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me just say by way of introduction.
Introduce yourself that, first.
Pardon?
Will you introduce yourself first?
Oh, yes,
great.
Please. That I have worked in this system. I'm the public member of the board and current chair, but I've worked in this system, as some of you know, for many, many years as the mental health director in Benton County, where I had responsibility for the supervision of certain people under the jurisdiction of the board, at the State Department of Human Services as the mental health administrator, where I had responsibility for the hospital as well as the community programs, and from which I retired in 2005. And now my sole contact with the mental health system is through this position on the board.
Your name, and, please.
Oh, my name is Barry Cast. I'm
Thank
sorry.
You.
I thought you said that. Forgive me. And I will say that that having seen the system from all sides, it's really reinforces what Mary Claire said a few moments ago, is that people's understanding of the complexity of the system, how many stakeholders are involved, and how diverse their perspectives are is really critical. So what I'd like to do in the next couple of minutes is just talk a little bit about how we make decisions and where we get information to do that. And the board meets weekly in hearings, mostly at Oregon State Hospital, but sometimes in community settings, to either receive someone on an initial commitment from a court, to respond to a patient's request for a hearing, which they can do every 6 months, or in response to the hospital's request for a hearing because a placement is appropriate or an evaluation for placement would be appropriate. The board is mindful that its statutory responsibility is first and foremost the protection of the public, but the board is also concerned about the welfare and the progress of each of the people under our jurisdiction. And so we also have monitoring hearings every 2 years for people in the hospital, every 5 years for people in the community. And much of our work is done administratively because people in the community, when their plans are to be changed, those plans must be approved by the board or under the board's designation of the executive director. And so this is with nearly 800 people in the hospital or in the community, there's a lot of work here. And there's a lot of people, and these are really weighty responsibilities. The board determines makes its decisions based on a determination of risk. We want as much data as possible to make those decisions. These decisions are not made lightly, and I will say, probably from the perspective of most of the patients in the hospital, it is very difficult to get out of the hospital and get to a community setting. The board has to be convinced, first, that the patient's risk is mitigated, and secondly, that the community setting is appropriate for their care. We use several factors to make those decisions. First, we receive a good deal of information in the record, which has accumulated over the years, and we can see the trend in the development of the person's psychiatric status from that file. In addition, we bring witnesses to the table, both from the community and from the hospital, and we hear the clinical judgments of people who have worked with many, many psychiatrically impaired individuals who are working toward their own recovery. We have the results of psychological testing and risk assessments that the hospital has performed. Now, the risk assessment process has been greatly improved over the past few years, not just in Oregon, but actually across the country, and a lot of that is coming from some work being done in Canada. There is a formal process, and it tries to approximate scientific data, if you will, but risk is also a matter of opinion, and that's something that we have to determine whether we have confidence in that judgment. It's based on historical factors, what kinds of crimes, what the diagnosis is, whether that diagnosis is based in, for example, some kind of traumatic brain injury versus a functional thing like schizophrenia, or those are historical factors, or dynamic factors that represent what kinds of treatment the patient has had and what kinds of progress they've made and what kinds of relapse prevention programs they have. Those risk reviews are becoming much more detailed, and the data from them is critical. And finally, and probably as important as anything else, we need to know that there is a community resource that is up to the challenge of providing care, treatment, and security to the public by taking responsibility for that individual. That is the most limiting factor. We have people in the hospital who are ready for community placement, but for lack of a place to live that is at the right level of security and safety, they remain in the hospital. And that, I think, is one of the points of greatest concern to us. And to me, with the budget problems that you are facing, that reduction in community services would be limiting for these people when they're ready to make the move to the community successfully. And I want to add that one of the things that is really striking to me and to other members of the board is that the people we're responsible for are not just psychiatrically ill and getting treatment for that, but many have comorbidities, that is, other diseases that are really pretty extensive. About 80% have some kind of alcohol or drug history and require continuing treatment for that. Reductions in those services would affect placement. And they also have extensive medical problems. I am sometimes aware of 8 or 10 very serious medical disorders, everything from asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, obesity, heart disease, post-surgical patients who have been the victims of traumatic brain injury. So there's a complex set of services that need to be focused on that patient in order for them to move to a community setting. And I think that's a key issue for your consideration. I think that pretty much sums up what we are looking at in a hearing. Some of these hearings take 2 to 3 hours to make that determination. It is not done lightly, and the board is very serious about its obligations to the public. And with that, I think I've pretty much explained what our process is. There are, I should add, there are 5 members of the board. 3 sit at any one time. Getting 3 members into the room is really a challenge, and I really respect greatly the responsibilities that Mary Claire and her staff have for monitoring community care, because the board only meets once a week, and the rest of that responsibility falls to them. And I commend her for managing that office with the burdens that it faces. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Mary Claire, I think before we move on to the next speaker, and that's what you were about to do, I think we'll open it up for questions. This is a very important issue, colleagues, that we're going to be dealing with throughout this session. So I want to make sure that you understand the issues that we're going to be dealing with. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mary Claire, way back in the beginning when you talked about diagnoses, you said something about personality disorder, and I didn't hear the first or second part of it.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, what I said was that personality disorders are excluded from the definition of mental disease or defect for purposes of asserting the insanity defense. Those persons with that diagnosis, those diagnoses are things like antisocial personalities, narcissistic personality, borderline personality disorders that are different than Access 1 diagnosis of major mental illnesses.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A couple questions I'm looking at. I don't know, at this?
Yes.
At this one?
Snapshot.
You have on the 367 conditional release, it says 7 out of state or country. Can you explain the country? I can see the state piece. Yes. But the
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, interestingly enough, there have been a couple of individuals who were conditionally released by trial judges. One went to Germany and another went to Mexico. And then we have a couple others that ended up in Mexico as well. So those some were directly decisions of a trial judge. And then a couple of those have been for individuals that the board determined had family and supports and services in Mexico and were allowed to return there.
Right. Follow-up?
Follow-up. And at the bottom, it has 16 others. And I... Your acronyms? I know what AWOL is,
yeah.
But and then I'm going to actually have you expand on those folks. So UL...
Chair, Representative Maurer, UL is unauthorized leave, which would be leaving from the state hospital. The DOC is persons who have dual jurisdictions and are currently in the Department of Corrections custody rather than in ours.
Mm-hmm.
And then the AWOL refers to people who have been on conditional release but have basically run away and at this point are their whereabouts are unknown. So that's the distinction there. And some of those actually date back to the creation of the board. At the time the board was created, we were to assume jurisdiction over anybody they could find that had a record in 1978. And the board at that time was not able to locate. So some of those go back to 1978.
Follow-up?
Just of the 16, how many are unauthorized leave and AWOL?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I'm sure I have that number, and I will
I guess if I was to look for the concern, you know, and try to parse out all of this, is as a result of the PSRB, it's not a blame. It's as a result of PSRB, mm-hmm. You know, what is the, do we have issues of people just walking away? And, I mean, the numbers don't look very significant, and if you carried over from previous history, then that would rationalize part of that. But is the PSRB, is there an issue of people just walking away?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, it does not happen frequently. There, occasionally, an individual who has been returned to the community is living in one of our with one of our contracted providers does leave the jurisdiction, and then we make every attempt to locate them and return them. But there are a few currently that have walked away from our jurisdiction. But as you note, you know, out of the 367, I think it happens, you know, maybe once a year So it really isn't a common occurrence that people would leave our the auspices of our authority.
Okay. I will stop there, but we can...
We'll come back to you.
Yeah.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just hoping as you go through the presentation, not necessarily directly in response to this question, you made it clear that a brain disorder can be treated with medication and supports and individuals can recover. I think the question that leaps into people's minds as they work through this issue is the assistance available for people to stay on their medications, or how often do you run up against individuals who need to still be on medication but choose not to take those medications? I think that's kind of a question that runs through the whole discussion, and so I'm hoping you could discuss at some point the individual's abilities to stay on necessary medications.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, it is a condition of release that individuals remain on whatever prescribed medications their treating psychiatrist requires. And so they are not given the option not to do so. To refuse to take medication could result in their return to the hospital. That would be a violation if in fact they that was a requirement of their treating psychiatrist. There are individuals under the board who are not on medication, but that would be as a result of the recommendation and assent of their treating psychiatrist. The ability to get medications, I will say that I think one of the beauties of our system is that, in fact, these individuals are insured that whatever services are needed are provided through DHS and the Addictions and Mental Health Division. For those who don't know, the way the system was set up is that the board's budget covers the running of the agency and the stipends that are afforded to the board members to sit. But the money for the funding for the actual care and treatment of our clients, both at the state hospital and in communities, is contained in the Department of Human Services budget, Addictions and Mental Health. And I, frankly think that is one of the reasons that these clients also are successful, is that unlike other similarly situated clients, to be honest, or individuals, to be honest, that our clients do get what they need, unlike other persons with chronic mental illnesses in the community that aren't guaranteed of that. And so if an individual needs medication or a particular treatment modality, that request is made to the Addictions and Mental Health, and they assure that community providers like Cascadia are reimbursed for that service. So that has not, been a problem overall, obviously, with the economic situation as it is. As Mr. Cass indicated, there is concern that if some of these services were cut back, it would be problematic. So,
thank you. Representative, did you have a question?
Ben Orman had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question, but one of the questions, and I think it was alluded to with your last comments, was my assumption is that these 744 may have had experiences prior to being put into the criminal justice system. So do you have any idea of how many of these 744 were in previous services outside of the criminal justice system, in other words, in the mental health system? And then how many this would be one of their first episodes?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, off the top of my head, I couldn't give you numbers on that, but I'd be happy to look into it. A number of our clients, especially the younger ones, it is the result of their first psychotic break. They didn't know they had an illness, but others clearly have had a longstanding mental health issue and either
you know, in the old days, as they said, stop meds because of the side effects, for example, or, frankly, didn't have the resources to get them because, as I said, they're not guaranteed to everybody in the community as they are to our clients. And so I think access, you know, we noticed a... And it's only anecdotal. I can't explain. When you look at some of this information that I provided you in the charts at the end of the packet, how the numbers go, you know, each year, you know, we stayed pretty steady for a while, and then we started seeing these spikes. In 2003, the board's new clients for a year jumped up to 126, and we used to only average 60 or 70. And so... And that, you know, many attributed that to the cutbacks in the Oregon Health Plan because people weren't able to get either the medications or services they need. And when that happens, as Representative Olson can attest, people end up, you know, coming to the attention of law enforcement, entering the criminal justice system, and then, you know, falling to us if, in fact, they choose to assert the insanity defense.
I guess that's the point I'm trying to make.
Any further questions of these two witnesses? If not, we'll move ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you. After, as Mr. Cass said, you know, the board makes these decisions, and at some point in the process, the hospital may well make a recommendation that this in one of these individuals is, in fact, ready to return to the community setting. And when that occurs and the board is convinced of that, then they would initiate conditional release planning. And how we do that is that we order an evaluation by a community mental health agency that we contract with to serve our clients. And I think this is another reason why, in fact, this system works so much better than the one that was in effect prior to the board's creation, because in those prior to that time, the decision was solely made by the state hospital staff, and they would just write to the trial judge and say, we think this person is ready, and trial judge would usually assent to that recommendation, and off they would go. But here we've added another layer to this process, and in which we get an independent assessment from a, you know, a different perspective from a community provider who ultimately is going to be responsible for these individuals. And so I've asked Bonnie Lambert from Cascadia to explain to you, once she gets that package, what we do is send a letter and the entire PSRB exhibit file, because we want these community providers to know everything about this individual that the board knows, so that there's no holding back any information. They're privy to everything we know, as well as any information in the hospital chart. And she's going to explain to you how that process then, you know.
Bonnie, I'm going to ask you to hold off just a minute, and I have a couple of questions to ask of Mary Claire. Mary Claire, so down at the bottom of this first chart that you have given us, it says 29 people have been appropriate for conditional release, but they're still in the hospital. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the 67 have had community evaluations, so they were in that first category, but now they're beyond that. So we're really talking about almost 100 people, right? And these folks are ready to leave the hospital. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Assuming that all 67 of those had evaluations that were positive, I didn't break that down. There are some people that have evaluations and the community doesn't believe that they're ready, but on the whole, most of those would be individuals who are have been assessed and are waiting for a bed, so to speak.
Right. If I recall from the federal study of the state hospital, that was one of the criticisms, wasn't it? That people are ready to leave the hospital, and yet we don't have places in the community for them. Is that?
Madam Chair, that's
remembering
correct.
That correctly? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Bonnie.
My name is Bonnie Lambert, and I'm the program manager at Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. What I thought I'd do is explain briefly our program and what we provide there to the clients, and then I'll go into the evaluation process. I've been a program manager since 2007, and before that I was a case manager since 2005. So I worked one-on-one with the clients under the PSRB. We have about 55 clients currently with Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare who come for treatment. Most of them have gone through this transition and evaluation process from Oregon State Hospital. We have a day program which has skills training, access to employment, access to resources in the community, and socialization for when they come out of the hospital. We have case managers on site for them to move through the process, problem solve, do stress management, therapy, all the skills that they need to kind of progress into the community. We have a psychiatrist on staff who sees them monthly, or if in crisis, they can see them as often as needed. We also have addictions treatment that we can attach to our clients if needed by their condition of release, and they have access to those groups and one-on-one counseling. Most clients that come out, they will start in a level of care. And in Cascadia, we have residential houses. We have about we have five of residential houses, which 24-hour staff, medication management, skills training on site. Most clients start in that level of care, just to make sure that they're doing well and are able to acclimate to the community and then start their kind of progression on their own. We have semi-independent houses, which are staffed 8 hours a day. This is when clients have shown that they're doing well and are independent on medications, independent on activities in the community. They'll progress to that level of care, which is still staffed, so that we are allowed to help them through that process and be part of that transition. We have an intensive case management program, which is independent living, but it's supervised heavily, because usually the transition goes from residential to an independent placement, and that requires us to make sure that they're doing meds correctly, that they're, you know, entering the community, that they're doing well. And so we kind of give them wraparound services to make sure of that. And then clients, if they've done well, they progress to an independent level of care where they're living on their own, taking their meds on their own, and managing funds, doing what they would have been doing perhaps if they, you know, had not had an illness and ended up in the criminal justice system. So we try to help and progress them to that level of care, and that's ultimately our goal, is to make sure that they can at some point stand on their own 2 feet. Like I said, the 55 progress through this level of care, but usually start with the evaluation process from the hospital. Like Mary Claire said, we have an evaluation packet provided, which has the police report, the assessments from the hospital, their progress notes, start to finish, from the incident that led them to be under the board to now. Once we get that packet, we'll review to see what their history is. We want to know them in and out so that we can assess their level of care and level of risk, you know, so that we can figure if we can mitigate and support and treat them. So we review their insight, their judgment, their hospital track record, their history prior to the hospital, any other treatment information that we can get our hands on to kind of familiarize ourselves with their care. And again, it's that independent assessment from what the hospital has said to what we see in front of us. So that we can kind of determine whether we want to allow them to come out and treat them. Once we've reviewed that packet, we'll meet the client. We have to set an appointment usually within 15 days. We meet the client for an assessment. Our clinical coordinator, who's on staff, will do an interview, review the crime, review history, insight, judgment, ask questions about, you know, what they believe will help them in the future, what they believe perhaps led to, you know, the incident that put them under the board. And it's all to determine if they have the building blocks of success, and that they can put that into play and say, this is the things that I need to not have this happen again in my future. Once we have that interview, obviously consultation is part of my job. I consult with my clinical coordinator, and we then refer the person to the psychiatrist who's on staff for another evaluation, and he again reviews the history and meets with the client to ask the same questions and gets more into the symptomology of the person and their illness. Once that process takes place, we consult again as a team to make sure that everyone is on board if the client is seemingly appropriate. The next step would be a residential screening, where they would meet with the person of that level of care. Usually, like I said, it's the 24-hour staffed house so that they can get more acclimated to the community. They'll meet with the administrator of the house, who, again, reviews the packet, reviews the record, and along with our Multnomah County representative, they meet with the client, talk about what is needed at the house, what's required at the house, kind of an informed consent. This is what to expect in our placements. Usually that means they are required to be at the house for the hours after the clinic ends. So they're usually, when they come out, they have requirements to be at the clinic for a certain amount of time for their treatment, and then the administrator talks about their requirements after that. So they would be chores, being on site for house visits and house meetings and that sort of thing. So they can kind of know ahead of time what level of care that they are in for, I guess. Once that that screening happens, they then will, we again consult and review and just get impressions. And there are, you know, we can say at this point maybe their judgment is not appropriate, maybe their insight, maybe their symptoms are a bit active or too active, and we can have the option of saying no and review again in 6 months. If most of the time we find that they're appropriate for placement and can transition, we would then report through our evaluation to the board. That's the written document by my clinical coordinator, the written document by the psychiatrist, and a conditional release plan. And that's it's a plan of support of what we feel, based on the history, would benefit this person and give them the best likelihood for success. It typically involves who the case manager is. It involves what type of home visits, what type of structure, what type of treatment. They have an option of, most of the time they're provided therapy, group therapy, which is psychoeducational, usually medication management. They're provided mental health education classes so that they can start to get more aware of kind of their stage of change, where they are, and work through what it's like to have a mental illness, and again try to move through that and be in the community. So they're provided mental health groups by my staff and other people in Cascadia. Like it was said before, there are co-occurring disorders of addiction with a majority of our clients. Because of that, we usually require education around addiction, education around relapse prevention, and 12-step groups, which are a part of Cascadia services. That goes into their conditions of release, and it becomes a requirement, as do the mental health groups. There's also to be on, you know, definitely on the safe side, UA screenings, definitely required oversight by a case manager, and they're placed on a certain level of care, which we call a level system. And it seems somewhat a contingency management, where they're provided freedoms once they've done things well for a determined amount of time, but it allows us enough time to see behaviors and rest our trust on those behaviors. So if a person is on, like, in our level system, it's 1 through 5, and those levels determine amount of freedom. 1 is they don't get passes in the community without a staff or a peer, and then up to 5, where they're allowed 8-hour to 24-hour passes with case management support. Like, if they've done well enough, they can, and they've talked to the family and talked to the person that they're visiting. So,
Bonnie, we have a question from Representative.
Mary Claire, Barry, and Bonnie. You know, I got to tell you, just listening here for the last 40 minutes from you, it just seems like you've thrown so much at us. And I think at one point I was thinking I was starting to get a handle on what was going on with PSRB and everything. And I just got to tell you, listening to Bonnie right now and trying to plug in everything else with what you've said, I'm not there. I mean, I'm for sure can't get my arms wrapped around it. But my first question, Madam Chair, to this group is, okay, now I understand the screening process. I mean, as what my, I'm trying to just break this down a little bit. For a patient to move out of the hospital, obviously the folks inside of the hospital themselves do an evaluation. Then the board themselves you hire an outside source to do a very involved assessment to move on. So that's the second piece of what I heard you were talking about a little bit, Barry.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, the board will find that a person based on the hospital's recommendation is ready to be evaluated by the community. We will order such an evaluation. I don't believe the board pays for those directly. They're covered in the cost of community mental health programs. That report comes back to us and becomes a part of the record along with a conditional release plan, which is a transfer to community care. The board will look at that plan and say, well, you know, it looks like a pretty good plan, but we think they need, in addition, individual therapy, two UAs a month instead of one, you know, urinalysis to test for alcohol or other substances, or make other modifications to the plan before a conditional release is authorized. Or the board may say this doesn't look sufficient to us, and the person will stay in the hospital. So we're struggling to find an agreement that the patient, the community, the hospital, and the board agree to. And until that happens, an approval is not granted.
Okay. Follow up. Then. Thanks, Madam Chair. Right. Then, Bonnie, I guess going to you then, following up with what Barry just shared, from your perspective then, you're in a constant flux of evaluation.
We get a number of evaluations per year, so we have to address each and every one of them within a timeline and do all those steps for each person. So our assessment, the doctor's assessment, the house's assessment, and collaborate with the hospital and the PSRB so that they're provided the level of care that's needed to keep them safe and healthy in the community. So it is a back and forth, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I just asked that question mainly. It's just a comment now, Madam Chair. Mainly because of what your mission is, basically for the overall protection of the public, that type thing, and you're just capturing that umbrella. So, thank you.
And I think it would be helpful. I agree with Representative Olson. We're trying to absorb a lot here, especially for people who Representative Olson and I have heard this a lot. So if we're having trouble, I know other people are really having trouble. So what I would suggest is maybe you already have it in here, Mary Claire and Bonnie, you too. If you sort of put it in an outline for us so we understand all the evaluations. And colleagues, what I'm hoping you will do is think about, as we hear this, think about one of these homes coming into your neighborhood and the kinds of questions that your constituents will be asking you and the concerns that they have. So I want us to be thinking about, because they will be coming into our neighborhoods, and they need to come into our neighborhoods. So I want us to think in those terms of how can we understand this, and how can we help our constituents understand these issues. Yes, Representative Cowan.
Madam Chair, in follow-up to that, and I say this now because perhaps folks can bring us back more information, I was looking at the one-pager that was handed out. And on the very last paragraph on the back side, it talks about whether secure residential treatment facilities are for people who have committed the most violent crimes. Notes that a number of the residents of these facilities have not committed violent crimes. And then on the right-hand side in the gray area, sort of lists a whole range, a spectrum of various kinds of residential facilities. I think in helping us answer the kind of question that you just put to us and answer those in our communities, it would be helpful to do some follow-up that focuses a little more on what each of these kinds of treatment residential living centers are, supply, level of security, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. Because that's where the community concerns are that we are trying to address.
Right. Good. And maybe we can go back at another time. Bonnie, I'm going to ask you to hold off.
Okay.
And I know that Representative Boone has a question. And if you would give us sort of, it sounds like you have lots of steps that you go through, mm-hmm. and I think it would be really helpful if we could read that. That would help us okay. incorporate that a little bit better. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And thank you for your comments about us thinking about community living situations, because I, out of my four counties, I have one that's just, you know, hopping mm-hmm. at the bit to get one. And I think what I would like to ask you is going back to, and maybe not just younger patients or clients, but since 80% have drug and alcohol issues, is that because it's they're self-medicating to stay, kind of trying to stay where they are. They're not identified. They haven't committed a crime or whatever. And there's a lot of mental health services needed in our communities that's not being met. And I'm just wondering, getting back to the community sense, is there some way that either in schools or is somebody watching out for people who might trigger, you know, something they do in class, for example, or in the community that people say, you know, do you need some help? Can I help you here? So that it doesn't escalate to the point where you guys are seeing people.
Representative Boone, we're going to have an overview of community mental health after these people are through.
Okay.
So I think that's a good question to ask them. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Great. Any other quick questions of this? Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you for coming today. Ms. Lambert, I teach at the community college. I have a number of students who've gone through who are Cascadia clients, have had a lot of success. I have a lot of respect for what you do. I'm wondering about, actually this is a question for Mary Claire, about the decision of where to place people who are in the hospital. What is the geographical basis of the decision? I see that people are spread out all over the state, and what are some of the factors that are taken into account to decide, well, should this person go back to their home area? Should they perhaps go to the metro area, you know, et cetera?
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrough, those decisions historically have been made on a clinical assessment of what program best meets the individual's needs. And so board is unlike the parole and probation system where individuals are required to go back from whence they came. That has not been the board's practice because, frankly, all communities are not created equal in terms of the resources that they can provide our clients. And so depending upon what types of residential and treatment programs a county has would be what the board would look at in determining where, in fact, first to refer the person. Now, as, you know, these, you know, development by addictions and mental health grows and we have, you know, a better continuum of both treatment and residential care throughout, you know, counties or even regions, then I expect we'll have a better opportunity to move people closer to, if it's appropriate. You know, there are times, frankly, that it's not an appropriate situation to send somebody back, either because of the nature of the crime, the victim's position on a particular case. And so the board has to weigh all of those factors. But a lot of it has, at least historically, been the limited number of placements the board has had to choose from. But as I said, as, you know, we grow this system in order to meet, you know, the needs of the mental health system in general, because obviously the hospital replacement project is premised on more individuals being in a community setting, that we would have the, you know, variety or that continuum of care in at least every region and have more opportunities to choose from, basically.
Mm-hmm. Can I just follow up? Thank you. And so is part of the reason for the backlog the, you know, geographical considerations because there's more pressure, say, to go to the metro area? Or to what extent is that a factor?
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrough, I think there's a couple of factors. I mean, clearly there aren't enough placements right now for all of them to go. And there are individuals who, you know, in trying to honor some consumer choice, that they want to go home or as close to home, and so they're willing to wait in the hospital for an opening, for example, in Lane County, and, you know, although, you know, beds don't come open there very often, you know, they want to stay because that's where they want to go. So that does happen on occasion, that there are people that just wait for a particular. You know, we have tried to, you know, talk to the patients about broadening their perspective a little bit, because we don't, you know, if there are openings in other parts of the, you know, state, it doesn't preclude them from returning to that, you know, home base at some point in the future. But if those resources aren't available and they are someplace else, we'd like to try and move them out of a hospital level of care if they no longer need that.
Right. That makes sense. Thank you.
Bonnie, unless you have something quick, I know we have a group of people here who would like to speak. So if there's something that you've missed out on that we need to hear, but if you could give us something in writing, that would be really helpful.
Sure. And Madam Chair, if I can
yes.
have 2 more minutes, because
sure.
I think, you know, once that report is received and the board reviews it, you know, the most when you talk about, you know, your the community concerns that each of you have expressed, it really comes down to the monitoring piece, which is, I believe, the most critical aspect, at least from the public's perspective. And I think that is, you know, frankly, where the board excels as well. It provides much more oversight than other supervising agencies such as parole and probation. When an individual is released, we enter their name into the law enforcement data system terminal so that with their name, the type of crime that they have been placed under the board for, a contact name, the case manager's name and number, as well as the board's, so that if the police come in contact, we immediately get a hit on that person. I have a staff person who has that LEDS terminal in her office, and every time it goes off, she calls the police immediately to find out what the nature of that contact was. We have daily calls and correspondence with case managers about these 367 that are on conditional release. We receive monthly progress reports, and I apologize. I know you know, you could go blind trying to see this sample of a progress report, and I will provide you, you know, a bigger copy. But basically, when they come out, the board dictates pretty much everything about their lives, from where they live, how often they see their case manager, how often they see the doctor, what groups they go to, how many hours they're in treatment per week, the whole bit. I mean, the curfew, everything about their lives is pretty, you know, structured by the board. And these case managers send us reports monthly of their compliance with that. So the board knows if they are complying. And if so, life goes on. They work through the program, as you'll hear from our consumers. And but if, in fact, something does go wrong, that either they violate that condition or their mental health were to decompensate even through no fault of their own, a critical aspect of the board is their ability to immediately revoke that conditional release and return them to the state hospital for care and treatment. And we don't have to wait until they commit a crime. We don't wait until they commit a crime or get to that point where they could be a risk of danger to others. We want to intervene early to catch it and to get them back on the right track. And then if, in fact, they are revoked, that whole process starts again. They're entitled to a hearing. The board determines whether they can go back out or whether they need to stay in a hospital setting for a longer period of time for stabilization. And so I just want to stress that, you know, there are critics that are, you know, mostly in the consumer group will, you know, the criticism has been of this board that it is, you know, too intrusive in people's lives. But I think that that goes to the fact that the board does take, you know, their mission to protect the public seriously. And I think that's one of the things that we want, you know, to the message that we want to have the community hear is that when people go back to the community, they're not released from the jurisdiction. They're only let out from a hospital, but they continue to be under board's jurisdiction, and they continue to be very closely monitored and, you know, are watched through that progression to the point where they can get to the most independent level, because, you know, it also should be noted that these individuals are placed under our board only for a set period of time by the courts. And so the board's goal is to get them to the level that they can, you know, best manage on an independent level, so that they're ready to do well even when that jurisdiction ends. So, and the only other point I want to make is I did note, you know, our recidivism rate, but I think what, frankly, is even more telling of how well these individuals can do is that last graph in your packet points out the percentage of persons that successfully remain in your communities per month. We are down, despite the fact that there are 367 on conditional release at this point, we are averaging less than 3.5 revocations per month. So in the year, calendar year 2008, 99.1% of board clients remained in the community, living and doing well. And so I think that that also evidences the fact that these individuals can and do recover, that they don't pose a risk to the community when those supports and services are there. And at this point, I would like to call upon our three consumers to share their yes. histories and perspective.
We want to hear that. And Mary Claire, before
yes.
you go,
yes.
we will have you back again, because
okay.
I know there are more questions here, and we will have Mary Claire back again and possibly Bonnie, too. And Barry, you're always welcome.
Thank you, Mary.
but one of our members here suggested that you send us the PowerPoint by electronically,
sure.
by email.
Absolutely.
That would be great.
I will do
Thank
that.
You so much.
And I will get some of that. That will work with Bonnie and
Great.
Get you a written summary of
Perfect.
The
this
process.
This is an issue we're going to spend a lot of time on. So thank you. It's nice to see folks again. And colleagues, I want to let you know that you may have some embarrassing questions to ask of these three presenters, and it's okay to ask them. I've asked Mary Claire if it's okay if you ask why they were in the hospital, what their issues were, what crimes had been committed, and I'm assuming that's okay with you. Mary Claire said that was all right. Is that true? Can
yes.
you? Okay. Because I think sometimes it's hard to ask those questions, especially in public. So thank you so much. Thank you. It's good to see you again, Ashley.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Good morning,
Pardon?
Ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ashley Brenton, and I'm a former PSRB client and a former patient at the Oregon State Hospital. Am I speaking loud enough?
Doing fine.
Just turn the mic a little.
Okay.
There you go.
I'm a former Psychiatric Security Review Board client and a former Oregon State Hospital patient, and I reside in Portland. I am a student at Portland State University, and the crime that I committed was in June of 2000, and I was arrested. To make a long story short, it was my first psychotic episode, and I was 44 years old, and I committed a very serious crime of robbery and assault and attempting to elude a police officer. And I was driving around Portland thinking everyone was out to kill me, and I stopped to buy $10 of gas. And when the gas station attendant reached in my car window for the payment, I don't know what I did with the money, but it did not go into his hand, and his arm got stuck as I sped away, and he ended up getting hurt, and I ended up being arrested at gunpoint for that robbery and the $10 of gas that I didn't pay for, and assault because he got hurt. This was my very first psychotic episode. I had no criminal history prior to this, and I had not had any mental health issues. I had had a broken neck in 97, and that might have contributed to a predisposition that I had to having a mental illness, but anyway, I found myself in jail for about three months, and I would not take my medications. I need to tell you that I was not cooperating because I thought that people were trying to poison me. So it's my nature to be cooperative, but I was delusional and hallucinating and seeing rats and that they were going to put in my cell and all kinds of things like that. I benefited from being at the Oregon State Hospital. I wish that I hadn't been there so long. I thought I'd never get out of there, but they had me make a treatment, participate in my treatment plan and things like that. And I learned about having a mental illness, and my diagnosis is schizophrenia, by the way. And eventually I was discharged from the Oregon State Hospital after a long time. And I, after a couple of years, I was reintegrated into the community and got back into school. My academics were you know, I was in school and out of school because of my, I had a mental health relapse when my doctors had taken me off my medication because they thought that I had initially been, had a problem with ephedrine, my diet pills that I was taking when I was first charged with my crime. So they didn't, at first they didn't think I had a mental illness. So after about a year or so, they took, my doctors took me off my medication, and I became delusional again, thinking everyone is after me to kill me. And was my conditional release was revoked, and that's when I went back to the Oregon State Hospital, and I was there forever, for over 2 years. And but then when I was eventually released back into the community, I got back into school, got involved with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and continued my academics at Portland State. I'm a women's studies major, and I have another year to go before I graduate. And got involved with the governor's mental health task force and the mayor's work group in Portland, and just have been trying to advocate for other people like myself that have committed these horrible crimes while we were sick. And I just would like you to know that medication and treatment, they do work. We just need to make sure that consumers get their medications, and education is so important for us to understand that mental health issues can be monitored. We can be supervised and have very productive lives. So that,
thank you.
And you're welcome to ask me any questions.
And I'm going to hold the questions until the three
okay.
have spoken, because we also are going to be hearing from community mental health programs, and I want to save some time there. But thank you so much for coming. It's
you're
always
welcome.
Good to see you.
Peter.
Okay. Is that okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. My name is Peter Clarkquist, and I was a PSRB client, and I was also a patient at Oregon State Hospital. My mental health issues started when I was very young and manifested as depression through my teen years until I was about 18 years old when I had my first manic episode. On November of 1997, after a week of growing psychosis, I drove down the wrong way on a one-way street at a high speed and got into a car accident and injured six individuals, minor injuries, I thank God, while I was sick. And I was under the impression or under the delusion that I was a ghost and my car was a ghost and that I was leaving the earthly plane. I didn't understand what was happening to me, and it was my first time having both audio and visual hallucinations, and I really felt like my mind broke on that day. And I was taken into custody and released 24 hours later of my own recognizance. After that, I did start receiving different mental health services for the brief period of time up until my trial, which was on June 10th of 1998. On June 10th, I was sentenced to 10 years under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and I was put in jail. I was ordered to be transferred to the Oregon State Hospital within 2 days, I believe, but due to a paperwork error, I was not transferred to the state hospital, and I stayed in jail. At that time, I was listening to voices, one manifested itself above the others, who stayed with me constantly and would tell me who was there to hurt me and who I could trust. And he also told me that my family was starving and had no food or water, and if I were to listen to him, then he would help get me out of jail and I could go to 7-Eleven and buy them food and water and bring it to them. And so I decided to do whatever this voice told me to do. And he told me that I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep and I couldn't drink water and I couldn't take any medications. And so they, in jail, they would bring their med cart by and say, it's medication time. And I would just say, no, I'm not taking any, thanks. And so they'd go on to the next cell. My parents at that time visited me regularly and were extremely concerned because when I spoke with them, they knew I was hallucinating. They knew that these things were going on, and they made repeated attempts to get me transferred to somewhere where I could receive help. A while after decompensating, I hadn't eaten or had anything to drink in about 3 days. And as a result of a conversation with my voices, I was instructed to injure myself. And so I did try to gouge out my own eyes. And after that, I banged on my cell door and asked the guard, or rather I just told him what I did, and they transferred me to OHSU, and I had emergency surgery, and they were able to save one eye but not the other. I continued to experience my psychosis in KCI Institute, and I was at Northwest One up on the hill. In Portland, OHSU. After a time there, I was transferred to the Oregon State Hospital, where I was given forced medication, which I actually was a little relieved when that happened, because then I was no longer responsible for it, and I did not have to hear any voices criticize me for taking medication. I was in the state hospital for about 3 years, and it took me a long time to get my sanity back and to get a rational mind, and I progressed through the state hospital, and I actually started to collect my reality again, and I was able to go to Transitional Living Center, which was a cottage on the hospital campus on March 1st of 2001. And I was there working on getting a conditional release, and I eventually did that and was placed in Portland at a group home called Pisgah. And that happened on October 2nd of 2001. I was so grateful to be back in Portland, near my family. I had my own bedroom. I had my own bathroom. I had a lock on my door. And it was a big step for me. And it felt really, really good. I went to Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare pretty much every day of the week, except for weekends, and I started out as a level one, and eventually I could go out for a half an hour pass to 7-Eleven, which was something that I had taken for granted prior to that, but it was really, it was exciting to be, healthy and in the community again. I continued to work my way through Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare until I was a level five. I petitioned the board and my case manager so that I could start going to school again at Portland Community College, and so that I could join a gym, which I did do. And I just tried to seize as many opportunities as I could while I was under the board, and they were, I was persistent, and, they would give me a little bit of trust at a time, and I was able to prove myself to them.
So are you out of conditional release now?
freedom?
I actually was given a full discharge on February 2nd of 2003, after 5.5 years under the board. Today I live independently. I'm going to school, looking for Microsoft certification. I'm working for an information systems company, and I have my own psychiatrist that I see every 3 weeks. And I'm very involved in the mental health community now as well, working for NAMI, Inner Voice, and the governor's PSRB sighting work group, and coming here. And I just thank you for letting me speak to you.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for coming.
My name is Susan Greenwald. I am under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, for committing a serious crime. At the time of incident offense, I was psychotic and sent to the Oregon State Hospital as a 370 until the time for evaluation, until the time I was capable of standing trial. I was stabilized and returned to the county jail for trial entry of plea preparation. After pleading guilty except for insanity, I was sent back to the Oregon State Hospital under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. After spending several years at the hospital and being seriously invested in my treatment, I was conditionally released to Providence and placed in a medical group home. Before I go on, I would like to tell you about my background. I was a legal assistant, a probate paralegal, commercial property management, and my first job at the age of 19 was for the late Honorable Judge John H. Hall, former governor of Oregon. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you this morning. At Providence, I benefited from the outpatient treatment by taking to heart the 10 basics of self-care: medication, nutrition, relaxation, exercise, affirmations, journaling, sleep, spirituality, and reaching out. After approximately 3 months in the Providence Rehabilitation Program, I was placed by Providence with the community people. And I was able to take classes in depression, anxiety, mindfulness, journaling, art therapy, assertiveness, cognitive behavioral therapy, and dialectical behavioral therapy, along with anger management. As a side note, when new groups were formed, I introduced myself by saying, "My name is Susan. I have a bipolar disorder, and it does not define who I am." Later, I went into the Luckdorf program, as Luckdorf had opened a new program for the residents, and I was a resident at Vallejo, a medical home. This allowed me to have medical issues taken care of, in that Vallejo had a nurse on staff 8 hours per day. While in the Luckdorf program, I started one-on-one therapy with an art therapist and truly benefited, as I myself am an artist and have been exhibited at the Hyde Gallery, Grossmont College in Southern California. I also had the opportunity to work one-on-one with an art therapist for 2 years in the Oregon State Hospital, and I'm very grateful for that. While attending Luckdorf's outpatient treatment program, I also attended Mount Hood Community College. I excelled in painting and struggled with art history. I then took a 9-week recovery course through NAMI. Today, I teach that course, work as a part-time volunteer at the NAMI Oregon office 3 days per week in their education department, and also speak and present for NAMI's In Our Own Voice, Living with a Mental Illness.
Susan, are you still at Luckdorf?
No, I no longer live in a group home and have my own apartment. This is through Cascadia Behavioral Health System's ICM program. Under the intensive case management program, I am checked on twice a day by a case manager, see a psychiatrist monthly, meet one-on-one weekly with my case manager, and attend an ICM group weekly.
An ICM is?
Intensive case management. This is the next step to independent living. This allows me to live in my own apartment in the community.
So, Susan, how long has it been since you left the state hospital?
That was approximately 2005. May of 2005.
Right. And can you tell us the crime that had been committed?
It's a serious crime, and I have received life under the board.
So you will be the rest of your life under the PSRB?
Yes,
and
I will be.
Could you tell us what the crime was, please?
Yes, it was an unclassified felony murder.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
While at the hospital, I had the opportunity to go through grief therapy twice.
Good, good. We're glad it's been a success for you. Susan, do you have any last comments before I open it up to questions?
I'd just like to share three things. Christy Morrison in the Empowerment Group wrote 12 articles of empowerment, and I paraphrased and adopted four of these to share with you.
Susan, what I'm going to ask you to do, because our time is...
Would you like for me to stop?
Yes, and could you send that to us? If you would
yes,
send it to us, that would be great. And you can send it to staff either by email or snail mail,
yes,
whatever would work for you.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You're
for
welcome.
Coming. Thank you, all three. So we have questions for this panel. Yes,
Madam Chair,
Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question. Susie?
Yes, Susan.
Sorry, Susan.
That's all right. Yes, Representative Maurer.
What do you do during your day when you're not seeing your case manager?
I continue to work for NAMI.
Okay.
Three days per week I work at NAMI, and then I teach peer-to-peer recovery courses. I'm starting another 9-week course February 7th, and then I go out and present for In Our Own Voice, which is another program, Living with a Mental Illness, wherein we go out and speak to groups and tell our stories.
So your days are busy?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That does raise a question with me. Are you on SSI then?
No, I have Social Security disability.
You have disability?
Retirement.
Okay.
Yes.
So do you other two then receive some income?
I received disability, I also work to supplement that.
Okay.
And I receive Social Security disability, and I also have student loans, which help me with my school expenses.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further questions? Thank you all so much for coming and sharing your story with us. You've done a fantastic job. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So now we're going to have an overview of Oregon Community Mental Health System, presented by the Department of Human Services. Great, thank you. And we just have a panel up here. And I think a lot of people have come in, and I assume you've come from NAMI. Is that correct? If you've come from NAMI, could you put up your hand? Great. Good. Thank you very much. Okay. And if people signed up, we don't sign up to testify to this, do we? Okay. So I'm hoping we can get through. We have six people, and so if you could take, so if you each take less, like 4 minutes, that's going to give us enough time. And I'm sorry to cut it short like that, but if you could keep that in mind, that would be helpful.
Okay. Good morning. Representative Tomei, Chair, and the rest of the representatives here. My name is Richard Harris. I'm the Interim Assistant Director of Addictions and Mental Health for the State of Oregon. I'm here to give a brief, very brief, overview of the mental health system and addiction system in the State of Oregon. The mission of the Addictions and Mental Health Division is to prevent and reduce the negative effects of alcohol and other drugs, gambling addiction, and mental health disorders, and promote recovery through culturally competent integrated evidence-based treatments of addictions and pathological gambling, mental illness, and emotional disorders. To really understand the mental health system, you need to understand that it is a system that has evolved over years, and it has its roots in both statute and in practice. Most of us would like to think that we could perhaps design a system that would be comprehensive and work. This is a system that has evolved over a long period of time. And so it has many components to it, and some of them are quite complicated in the way the system is funded. So I'm not going to go into great detail about it, but just give a brief sort of overview about how it works. Fundamentally, it's a shared system and a partnership between the state of Oregon and the 36 counties. The authority for the delivery of mental health services is shared with the state and with county commissions, who are the mental health authorities, and their designees in each county. So we have a system where the state of Oregon is providing financial assistance and guidance and contracts with counties, and the counties are responsible, by and large, to deliver the services in the community. This also includes managing the state hospital system, where there are at least three institutions, state hospital institutions, that are managed directly by the state. This county-state partnership provides an array of different kinds of services to people in the community. Everything from acute care, residential services, outpatient, crisis, and there's a separate system for both adults and for kids. It also includes a system that is somewhat separate for addictions treatment, although these services also are provided through the counties. In addition to this, you've spent the morning listening to how the PSRB system works and the treatment or the institutional care for PSRB-committed individuals is at the state hospital. So that is also something that the Mental Health Division has responsibility for. So in a way, you could see a system where there are services for civilly committed individuals at the hospital as well as PSRB committed individuals. These mandated services also extend out into the community, so the houses Luke Dorf, Providence, and others that you've just heard this morning are facilities that are licensed by a Division of Mental Health Services, and many of them are funded through the Division of Mental Health Services. So when we look at who is being served in the system, we know that in the adult mental health system, we're seeing someplace and around 85,000, 86,000 individuals and about 34,000 children in 1 year have received services through the mental health system. The funding for those services, again, is one of a mix where we have state general fund and where we have Oregon health plan funding for those who are eligible for Medicaid. And in total, in the last year, we spent about $747 million in mental health services. About $400 million of that are come through the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid matched, meaning that there is a flow of federal dollars that match the state dollars in Medicaid, and this is matched with about $346 million. In general fund that go directly to support these services, both at the state level and at the county level. On the alcohol and drug side, last year we served approximately 56,000 different adults and about 6,000 adolescents in the addiction services programs. For funding for those programs, approximately $94 million come in the way of funds from outside of the health plan and about $42 million funded within the Oregon Health Plan, which brings me to the discussion about the funding for services. we need to understand that general fund is the basic funding source here that helps match with Medicaid, but that's a big part of the mental health system and addiction system is general fund. We have other special funds and block grants that come from, by and large, the federal government, both for mental health and for addiction service block grants. And then finally, we end up having the Medicaid match that comes into the program. So there's really three general funding sources that help fund these services.
And it would be great if you could get, maybe you already have it in the materials you gave us, but it would be helpful to us to have those figures in front of us.
And we will give all of those figures to you. I didn't bring them today, but it's we'll bring them over.
That's great.
Which creates one of the issues that we're faced with now is that some of these, in the budget the governor has presented, there's reductions in these services, in these funds, and it's because there's a
lot
of
general
funds.
You know, we're a little early to be talking about funding right now, so I think what we wanted was sort of an overview about mental health and addiction services.
The only point I want to make here, Chair Tomei, is that we're heavily dependent in general fund in this for mental health services,
right.
And it presents some complications for us. The advantage, of course, is that there are funding is spread out over various components, including Oregon Health Plan, Medicaid, and beer wine tax, special grants, and block grant funding. So the system is really a partnership between the state and the counties, and Rod Calkins is here from Marion County, and he'd like to talk with you a little more in detail about how services are delivered at the county level.
Great, and thank you so much. And Rod, again, what we're looking for here is sort of an overview of mental health services in the county, and later we can start talking about funding. But I want the committee to understand how mental health programs are administered in the counties.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will try to be brief also. Chair Tomei, committee members, I am Rod Calkins, and I am the health administrator, both public and mental health director for Marion County. I am going to touch on some points in this handout that you have entitled the Community Mental Health and Addiction Services. I will try to keep it brief, as I said, but I and other community directors would be most eager to come back and talk with you about these, more of the details as the session progresses. I want to talk about the Community Mental Health Program in the context of the community-state partnership that Richard was referencing. This partnership actually goes back to the beginnings of statehood. Local mental health authorities were established to control the size and cost of the state hospital and to ensure that individuals could receive services in their home communities. The local mental health authority assures that in the context of a statewide system of mental health and addiction services, that communities can create services that match their local needs. The partnership we're talking about is a partnership in more than just name. Counties contribute over $82 million of county general fund to mental health and addiction services directly, plus considerable in-kind contributions. I think you all know that communities in Oregon vary greatly in terms of their needs and in terms of their resources. And the local mental health authorities are responsible for creating community mental health programs that meets their community's needs. Some counties provide those services directly. Some counties contract with community agencies for those services. And some do a combination. You have a handout describing the local mental health authority. This was created, I might point out, for county commissioners. And on page 3 of that handout are listed the components of a community mental health program. As you can see, those services span the gamut from preventive services to paying for acute inpatient care. I won't go over them all, but I wanted to note that community mental health programs provide 24-hour crisis services, as well as outpatient mental health and alcohol and drug services, such as case management, individual, family, and group therapy. Community mental health programs are responsible for a number of other functions as well. They ensure that individuals are safe and that abuse is reported and investigated. They provide contract monitoring, quality assurance, and gatekeeping to assure appropriate access to services. Oregon, as you know, has a plan for the state hospital, the State Hospital Master Plan. There is a community services work group report which describes the investment in community services that are necessary to make that state hospital plan successful. And this work group report is currently being updated, and we'll make it available to you as soon as it's ready. The important point is the state hospital master plan won't work without investment in such community services as alternatives to hospitalization, respite, diversion, crisis services, as well as brief acute hospitalization. I think you also have a copy of this handout, which is titled Oregon Speaks, and that details a number of the investments that need to be made in community addiction services, and we'll be happy to come around and talk with you about that as well later. I want to highlight a few of the successes and works in progress, and then we'll pass it the baton. Over the last couple of years, the Children's System Change Initiative has been quite successful in moving services for children and their families closer to their home community. These services involve a wraparound approach with a family team as the focus for treatment planning. Expansion of these kinds of services, such as that envisioned by the Healthy Kids Initiative, really need our support. This has been very successful. Integration with physical health care and wellness programs are especially important because it's all too true that many of the recipients of mental health services die far too young, especially compared to their peers.
Rod, I'm going to stop you right there because you're in Marion County and you can more easily come to talk with us than people who are further away. So I'm going to stop you because we need to learn a lot more about this, and these printed materials are very important to us. So thank you for bringing that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for letting me speak to you.
You bet. Please come back.
Hello, Representative Tomei and committee. My name is Jamie Farish. I'm the Executive Director for Oregon Family Support Network, which is a statewide family organization comprised of all family members who are serving family members in Oregon who have children with emotional, behavioral, and special health care needs. But actually, I'm coming here today as a mom as well, and I am a mom of a 12-year-old son who has early onset bipolar disorder and PTSD. And so I wanted to tell you just a little bit about him and what community-based services and supports have worked for our family. And I just want to make sure that when I leave here today, you're gonna know a couple of the things that definitely are working for families in the state. When my son was very young, I knew something was a little bit off with him, but he had a lot of medical procedures, he had some special health care needs. And so we progressed along, kept working with him, and clearly it developed into more of that, something that certainly was nothing I had experience with, regardless of all the training that I had. I worked in special education in early childhood, so I actually had a pretty big parent toolbox, and none of those tools were working. And some time went by, and really our family kind of sunk into despair and isolation and darkness. And I had knocked on every door I knew, and I knew of a lot more doors than many of our parents, just from working in school systems and being aware. And there were two people that helped us begin to come out of that darkness. And one was our pediatrician. So the first theme here is that integrating mental health and physical health is very important. My pediatrician looked at me one day and said, things are not going well for you, are they? And he began the process of getting referrals, which really led us down the road to beginning to figure out what was really going on with her son. And the second was actually a parent, and the theme there is peer-delivered services. And when we say peer-delivered services, it really means people who have experienced what you've experienced or similar to that are reaching out and helping you. And I had a parent that reached out to me actually with the Visions for Tomorrow class, which later I was trained in and taught for like 10 years. But she reached out to us, and for the first time I walked into a group, into a room, and there were parents, and I listened, and they had kids like mine. And I cannot tell you what that experience was like for me. I knew they had to be out there, but we could not find one another because we were all struggling in the dark alone. And even though some of us were searching, we could not find one another. And suddenly I was in a room with parents, and they understood. And in a look, in a glance, I didn't even have to really talk about how I felt about it and what I was going through. Because the look back at me, to the eyes of those parents, where they knew. They already knew. And that is part of
the family support network that you're referring to?
No, well, originally for me, my first experience was with NAMI in a Visions for Tomorrow class, which is a peer-to-peer class. And then that did lead me to Oregon Family Support Network, which is focused on a whole variety of peer-delivered services and working with parents and everything from support groups to a huge variety of training, collaborative problem-solving, wraparound, all types of things. And that's really what led kind of the journey. For my child, which now is really the face of the non-Medicaid eligible population, he has experienced hospitalization, residential treatment, exclusive school settings, a voluntary placement through child welfare, now a therapeutic school placement through ESD. He's experienced a lot of things, and to compound his tough start in life, we were also foster parents, and he was sexually molested by a foster child that was in our care, unknown to us at the time, which caused mental health to really plummet.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
Just wrap it up? Okay. Yeah. So what worked for us was therapy. And it really did make him whole and bring him back to us. And we did not know if it would, but it did. So I would just like you to remember that wraparound philosophy, values, and principles. I know you guys are going to be hearing about it if you haven't already heard of HB 2144, but it's coming. And peer-delivered services, integration of mental health and physical health are all very important. So thank you for letting me share part of my story today with you.
Thank you so much, Jamie. And did you give us any printed material about any of these programs?
I will. I have some. I'll leave with you.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Hi. I just want to remind you we're time limited, so I know we want to hear from you today.
I will be as brief as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me speak. My name is Megan Cahe. I'm the Peer Wellness Coordinator of Benton County Health Services. I'm also Vice President of Mental Health America of Oregon. What I'm here today to do is talk to you about what it is like from a mental health consumer's perspective to go through the county mental health system. And I'll be talking to you about what my experience was for many years as a mental health consumer in the county system, and that would be Benton County that I was a client of before. Now I work there as a peer wellness counselor, and it's the first time in my life that I've worked full time because I was on disability and SSI for many, many years. So I was diagnosed with schizophrenia when I was 19, and I moved to Benton County in 1992 and immediately entered into the county mental health services. And so I have seen therapists through the county for years until I started working there. I've seen psychiatrists through the county and had medications prescribed. Also, at times when I've had more trouble functioning, I would either, if I were doing very poorly, I would need to go up to the hospital that was in the community and be on the inpatient ward. That was, at a time in my life, very frequent. So in my life, I've been hospitalized actually over 100 times. Thankfully, that's over for me now, and I'm doing much better, and I'm able to give back. But another option that was open was sometimes to go to respite care. And unfortunately, in Benton County, there's just one respite bed that's open right now, so we need more options for respite care. One thing that we're doing with the Peer Wellness Program, which I'm the coordinator of, is we have a peer wellness workforce where we have peer wellness counselors, and those are people that have gone through peer wellness training, and that's an 11-week training program. And these are people that have lived experience of mental illness and who are doing fairly well with their recovery and who are able to work as peer counselors with clients. And so this is not to replace clinicians or case managers, but to work alongside and to say, well, I've been where you are, to the people who are so struggling, and to offer another option of care.
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up.
So we need all the options that are possible, and we need more beds at the inpatient hospitals, and we need respite care. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan. And she did leave off a brochure, which is excellent. And I'm so glad to see that you're recovering so well and having so much success in your
life. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. And I think we have three more people, or two more. Two. Chris Boneff and Robin Henderson.
Thank you, Chair. Sure, thank you, Chair Torme. I am Dr. Robin Henderson. I'm Director of Behavioral Health Services at Cascade Healthcare Community, which is the only acute psychiatric hospital east of the Cascades. We are a general tertiary care center and the largest hospital east of the Cascades, but we are also the only acute psychiatric facility east of the Cascades. So we service all of the 18 counties over there, along with the overflow from the valley. But I am here today to speak to you on behalf of the Oregon Community Mental Health Coalition. I am the co-chair of the coalition. Jeff Davis, who you may know from Marion County, is my other co-chair, and he was not able to be here today. But I represent a voluntary group of very dedicated consumers, family members, private and public service providers, healthcare professionals. Basically, just about everyone who touches mental health in Oregon belongs to the coalition. We came together in 2007 in response to the State Hospital Master Plan because we felt that looking at the State Hospital Master Plan, the missing piece was the community system of care, which you're all here to work on and to hear about today. So what I want to take my time to do today is to familiarize you with what our agenda is for this year, what we're looking at from a broader 50,000-foot level, and also where we see some of those holes. I'm going to make the broad assumption that you're all familiar with the public consulting group report, correct?
I think not.
I think not. All right, I'll give you a briefing. Last session in 2008, the legislature approved funding for a study done by the Public Consulting Group. PCG is what it's referred to in its acronym at this point. And that study looked at the gaps and where we needed to go as a state in our community system of care. They did an assessment with all of the different varieties of healthcare organizations, county mental health programs, all corners of the state, really looking at where were the critical needs that we had. And that report is being delivered to your offices. If you don't already have it, I would highly encourage you to read the executive summary. It's a big, thick document. Read the executive summary thoroughly and read the recommendations, because those recommendations talk about where we need to go as
so
a healthcare
system.
Could
you guess that report? Could you make sure that all of our members have that report? Do we have it already, Madeline?
I believe that Jane Ellen hasn't been able to deliver it yet.
Okay. Thanks so much. Okay.
Yes. We're waiting for it, too. We're critically interested. I've seen drafts of it and helped with that. But some of the key points that they talk about include implementing recommendations for regionalization of our healthcare systems. You've heard from a lot of consumers today who've talked about the variety of systems that they touch. And that was what was so intriguing to me, was to hear them talk about this program and that program and this program. That network has to exist in all of our communities in order for us to be able to serve people where they live. Out where I am, out in the central and eastern Oregon, we have bits and pieces of that, but we don't necessarily have the broad array of services. And that puts folks who live in some of our more rural communities at a huge disadvantage. But even in those urban areas, some of the cuts that are being proposed would wipe out those services for the people that we all serve, the consumers and family members we serve. We are critically interested in integration. One of the keys that we know to caring for folks and to lowering the healthcare costs overall is the integration between physical and behavioral health. You'll hear folks talk about how folks with a severe and persistent mental illness have a lifespan 25 years shorter than those who do not. That is a stunning statistic. If this was any other segment of our population, there would be a national uproar. But for some reason, it seems to be okay to just accept that that's 25 years off your lifespan with a severe and persistent mental illness. A lot of times that's due to the physical illnesses that come from many of the psychotropic medications and the lack of medical care. You heard folks talk about that paranoia and the delusions and those types of things, the fear around taking medications because of the poisoning of the body. Well, imagine if you're too scared to go to your physician to deal with your diabetes or to deal with what are very treatable conditions, and that's what we see in this population. So integration is so huge for us. Peer-delivered services, funding of the system of care, I won't go into that, but those are the types of things that we're really critically interested in. And the biggest thing that we really want to do is make sure that you know that the members of the Community Mental Health Coalition are here to come to your hearings, to be resources for you, to talk with you about our perspective as providers, healthcare professionals, consumers, and families. Every year we all come to the legislature and the pot of money comes out and we kind of all sit there and go, okay, well, I want this piece and I want this piece and I want this piece. And in 2007 we all decided that the more we did that, the more fractured our system would become. So we all needed to come together and say, this is the package we need, this is the package we're all going to advocate for, and when you give us what you can, and we know you'll give us what you can, then we work together to disperse it so that this whole system gets as much as we can. And that worked in 2007, and we're committed to that in 2009. It was interesting. Yesterday I had the opportunity in another hearing to watch the inaugural ceremony, which was a really powerful thing to do when you're in the Capitol. It's kind of freaky, actually. And one of the things that I heard President Obama say is that we all have to ask ourselves the tough question, does it work? The PCG report really looks at that tough question about Oregon's mental health system and says, does it work? And in the places that it's not, it says, here's what we need to do. Committees like yours have got to ask those questions this year in your deliberations, and I really want to thank you for the time to tell you about the Oregon Community Mental Health Coalition, and I'm happy to come back anytime you'd like.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming, and we will definitely have a hearing after we get that report in our hands so we can discuss that. Thank you so much. I understand you're the new director of NAMI.
I am, but I'm not new to NAMI. But, yes, my name is Representative Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Chris Bonneff. I am the executive director of NAMI Oregon. NAMI is a national alliance on mental illness. We're a national organization that provides support, education, and advocacy for people suffering with mental illness, living with mental illness, and family members. If you want to know more about many of our programs are mentioned today, we have an excellent website, NAMI.org, which details all our programs and services that we provide across the nation. I represent the state chapter. We have 16 affiliates across the state that deliver all these programs on the front lines. And I will be very brief because I know it's going to be a long session. But I'll tell you what NAMI wants in the end. We want a system. We do not have a system. It angers me a lot of times when we use the word system because we don't have a better word. What we have are a mishmash of services. In short, what we really want is, as bad as some people think the physical health system is, we would like a delivery system at least that good because we don't have that. If you are sick and you go to your doctor, that doctor will treat you. If you need something else, that doctor will refer you. If you got a quality clinic and you have health insurance, oftentimes they'll make that appointment for you and your records will be there when you go see that specialist. Here in our system, the story earlier about seeing a pediatrician being able to make a referral, that is an irregularity in our system. We don't have integration. We have a physical health system, and then we have the mental health system, which really, again, is just a mishmash of services. We would like a system. We would like to be able to enter somewhere and get the help we need and get the resources we need. We would like that system to engage us as individuals seeking care. We would like that system to engage us as family members. If you have a child who's suffering with cancer and you need to go to a specialty hospital, they treat the whole family, not just the child. If you have a child who needs specialty care in this state, it's only recently, in the last 5 to 10 years, that you were viewed as the problem, as maybe causing that mental illness. That's not a system. It's just this mishmash blame game, and there's various reasons for it. Is that I heard the word evolved compared to the mental health system. The system hasn't evolved. It's been in the dark ages forever. Only recently is it starting to evolve because the stigma is now being lifted, and the science is being developed. So we know what works. We would like a common set of a standard of care. When you're a consumer engaging a practitioner, you face an alphabet soup of practitioners, LPC, MSW, LCSW, clinical psychologist, PhD, psychiatrist. Where do you go? In the physical health system, it's pretty easy. You start with your MD. And from there, quality of care and a system of care helps you along the way. And when it's all said and done, when this session is over, and for all that we advocate for, that's really our aim, is that we want a system. We want a system that engages us. We want a system that's accountable. We want a system that guarantees a quality of care. And if it's not working, we want to see adjustments to it so that we get the quality we deserve. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Fascinating. Thank you so much. I'm going to call on Representative Van Orman and then Representative Boone. Anybody over here?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for NAMI. And the PCG, because in the discussion, it appears that one of the drivers of the system are the multiple funding streams. Is that an accurate perception?
Representative Van Orman, yes, it is. It's we have a very complex, there's all these, and again, it's the physical health system is not perfect. It also has all these buckets. But our system, what it is, has even more buckets and more funding streams. And on the provider side, it's very difficult to navigate to find out who's eligible for what so they can receive what services. And then on the receiving end of that, you don't know where to go. So one provider may be able to help you if you are in this bucket, and if you're not and you're in a different bucket, that service either is not available or you have to go find another provider, putting up more barriers to care.
So
follow up?
Yes, please. Thank you. Sorry. So one of the issues from my vision is the federal involvement in all of this as well.
Yes, Representative Tomei, Representative Van Orman. Yes, there are some federal issues involved in that, and I know in my service with the Oregon Health Fund Board Subcommittee, I mean, we looked at, even in the physical health system and mental health system, the difficulties and what streamlining can occur. I have more hope that with the new administration that our Medicare and Medicaid system will be a little more responsive to state needs in that way.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that thank you, Mr. Bonneff. It's good to be the last guy on the dais because that's who we will. Not that we wouldn't remember everybody else, but we really will remember what you said. And I would like to emphasize that the brain is part of the body, and so having an integrated service system with mental health services rather than separate from the physical medical health services, I would love to see us adopt that. And that's something that why I got out of treatment in when I was working in treatment of child abuse prevention or child abuse treatment and went into prevention. And now am here to try to make some changes in the system so that on that other end, we will finally be able to deliver the services that we need to. And I think you might be a part-time constituent of mine. So, thank you. It's a great way to meet your constituency.
Any last questions? Thank you so much. Thank you all so much. This is only the beginning of this conversation, and we will be continuing this. Could you both contact my office? I'd like to meet with you. Okay. Any other comments for the good of the order? We finished right at 10 o'clock. We started right at 8 o'clock. Very good. I call.
Meeting adjourned.
Meeting adjourned.